This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you're lucky, you've been to a natural history museum and stared in wonder at fossils that are millions of years old. Part of the amazement we feel at seeing artifacts of our earliest ancestors or dinosaurs or other creatures that predate humans is knowing that they're the real deal. But is authenticity really essential to their educational or scientific value? Advanced 3D printing technology is giving museum curators the option of keeping their most rare and fragile artifacts safely tucked away while still putting science and history on view to museum visitors. Here to talk with us about her work with 3D printers is Carolyn Thome. She's a digital model maker at the Smithsonian Institution. And we read about the Smithsonian's efforts to craft perfect replicas in the Atlantic magazine. Carolyn, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So what is the Smithsonian using 3D printing for?
Just as you said, we are replicating some artifacts that are either too fragile to be on display or they're not in our possession. Mostly, obviously, artifacts that we can get digital data from. And sometimes we actually are not even duplicating artifacts. We make models. And that's my main job, is to create models for exhibits.
So I did read about replicating an extremely rare skull. This is something that you do. You make models of rare skulls.
Yes.
How do you actually do this?
At the Natural History Museum, we have a medical CT scanner in the anthropology department. So a lot of the fossils and even some modern bones are scanned there. And so the digital data is collected for researchers to look over these artifacts or to share them with other institutions. So we get that scan data and clean it up digitally, because sometimes it has some digital noise to it. And then we will send it to the 3D printer and print it for whatever use. Usually it goes on display at the museum, or it's to share with other researchers around the world.
So how about choosing an example of something you have replicated, brought through the whole process?
I have Homo floresiensis, which is otherwise known as the Hobbit, something that we have duplicated about 10 or so times. It is a fossil that was found in Indonesia on the island of Flores in a cave. And the fossil is still in Indonesia, but there is a researcher, Dr. Matt Tocheri, who was able to CT scan and laser scan all the bones from this one individual. And he has the digital data for that. And he works with the Indonesians in providing copies to other institutions. So we 3D print the bones that they could find. And then when they come out of our printer, we hand paint them to look like the original.
So could a museum viewer pick out which fossils have been printed? I mean, are they really good replicas of the originals?
They are really good replicas. But what we do at the Smithsonian is, if something is on display and it is not the actual artifact, it is part of the label. It's always identified.
What's the advantage of 3D printing for this kind of work rather than making molds otherwise?
There's a couple things. You can make a digital copy of something, which means you're not handling it as much as you would if you were making a mold. So if you're making a mold of something, you're putting rubber on it and you're handling it a lot and you're exposing it to chemicals. If you're making a digital copy, you're laser scanning it or CT scanning it or using photogrammetry to create the object. So you have very little interaction with the object and definitely no chemical interaction with the actual object. And also for 3D printing, the thing I like to go by is, if it can't be manufactured in another way, then 3D printing is the way to go. Mm-hmm. So say for skulls that are CT scans, so if they're CT scan, they have the interior information and the exterior information, and then you can print all of that. You couldn't have made the interior information from doing a cast.
What are some of the other artifacts that you're replicating, or is it all the bones and fossils?
A lot of it is bones and fossils. Quality of the print really lends itself to bones. But another group that we're working with is the Repatriation Office. A lot of artifacts are going back to the tribes that claim them, and we ask permission to make copies for our own research collection.
It adds so much to the museum experience to see something, the original Mona Lisa, you know, that's just an example.
Right.
And the museum would never say this is a print of a painting and say it's equal to the originals. So what is the difference, do you think, between looking at a copy of an artifact, you know, that hobbit skull, for example, and seeing a really good print of a famous picture?
The hobbit skull you would never be able to see. You would have to go to Indonesia. So we're providing a way for the visitor to get the same feeling as looking at the real skeleton, and also putting it out there that it is a copy. So for the Mona Lisa, you know where it is. You have to go to it to go see it.
Right.
If you want to go to the Indonesia to go see the Hobbit, you can do that too.
Does that do anything to your sense of wonder when looking at an object? You know, if you were seeing a display that said something was a replica, would it feel the same?
First of all, I see it from a model maker's point of view. It's like, oh, wow, that's a really nice job. You know, they did a great job on that. But I think I've just been educated enough to understand that the real thing can't be on display. I think as long as I know ahead of time that there might be some copies out there, that's fine.
Is there any concern about that at all, that you're kind of, I don't know, opening the tube of toothpaste of making great forgeries as someone who's in the museum business?
I don't even go there to think about that. I'm a good federal employee who is just doing her job to make models for exhibits. In my mind, it's not really a worry, but I'm sure there's people out there working on these.
Well, Carolyn, thank you for speaking with us.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Carolyn Thome, she's an exhibit specialist, digital model maker for the Smithsonian Institution. And you can find links to read more about her work, creating 3D models of hominid skulls for a traveling exhibition. It's called Exploring Human Origins. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Now to an historical museum show in New Hampshire that required some old-school detective work.
Well, my name is Astrida Schaefer, and I'm a costume historian, independent scholar. I have my own business in which I make mannequins for museums to show their historic textiles on.
Okay, so there's a job you may not have known existed. Recently, Astrida curated an exhibit called Embellishments, Constructing Victorian Detail, which is on view at the Portsmouth Athenaeum until November the 6th. The show features a number of striking dresses from the late 19th century, each with its own fascinating backstory.
For me, it is very much being a sleuth. I get presented with an object like this dress, and at times very little information, and I have to examine it and pick up clues and put together pieces and connect the dots to find the woman inside the dress.
So Astrida Schaefer is something of a dress detective. And when we spoke to her, she told us the story of cracking one of the toughest cases in the exhibit.
The dress is this lovely ribbed silk, so it has a bit of texture to it, and it has a lovely shine to it because it is silk, and it's this kind of weird color. It's maybe pale gray or cream colored. It's really hard to define. It has ruffles, pleats on the skirt. It has decorated sleeves with fringe and intricate pleats on the cuffs. It's quite elaborate. And it looks like it belongs to someone who has a lot of social status.
The dresses on display at the Athenaeum actually come from a textile collection owned by the University Museum of UNH. Originally assembled as a teaching tool for the Home Economics Department in the 1920s, the records that once identified these garments were lost long ago.
So this is an example of this great garment, and no information in the files other than a number.
To rediscover the origins of the pale gray dress, Schaefer first had to examine its design.
The first thing I do is I look at the way the bodice is pieced and sewn together, because in the 19th century, you can really date something by the number of pieces that go into the bodice or the top part of a dress. Does it have a center back seam? All kinds of little tells.
With these tells, Schaefer is able to date the dress's construction to the 1870s. But her biggest clue was not in the detail. It was written on the inside of the dress.
Someone had taken ballpoint pen, which is really unusual to do, and written on the skirt waistband, B. Freeman, Somersworth, New Hampshire. Now, that's not something anyone in a museum would ever do to an object. This is, however, something that maybe the owner might have done before handing it over.
And so, armed with a last name and a decade, Schaefer had all she needed to solve the case.
I started searching through inventories, probate inventories, and census records, and so on. And I found there was only one Freeman family in Somersworth in the 1870s, a woman named Celestia, who is married to Cyrus. And as it happens, in the 1870s, she gave birth to a little girl named Bessie. So there we go. There's our Bee and our Freeman.
The process of discovering the owner of the pale gray dress is pretty incredible. Folded into the elaborate designs are a much deeper story about status, identity, and the birth of DIY fashion, because this dress was not bought, it was handmade. And where you or I might only see an old-fashioned garment, Astrida Schaefer sees so much more.
Celestia did not really know what she was doing, basically. There are things like the buttonholes being far too small. The overskirt is just not put together very well. It's kind of, it hangs funny. Some of the pleats on it, especially the pleats on the lovely collar, are one particular kind called a knife pleat. But the very back of the neck has three box pleats, which have a very different structure. And those were supposed to be centered on the back, and she rather spectacularly missed. I mean, they're completely off center. No professional would have made a mistake like that. So things like that are tells that this was made by somebody who didn't really have the technical skills to tackle the dress, but she did anyway.
So why would Celestia attempt such an impressive but ultimately amateurish recreation of high fashion?
Cyrus was a textile mill overseer, which is basically a mid-level management position, not one that afforded him a great deal of money. He was listed as having a worth of $500. And if Celestia had wanted to go and purchase a professionally made garment for herself, that would have been at least $350. There's no way she could have done that. So the only way that she could make herself the woman of status, the woman who mattered, that she wanted to, was to make the garment herself.
So here was a woman who created a dress as an act of transformation. It may not have been perfect, but the gray silk dress marks a unique era for DIY fashion. For many women of modest means, it was the first time that high design was within reach.
You have three things that came together at once. You have the invention of the sewing machine and its entry into the domestic sphere. You have a huge burst of fashion magazines geared toward women that are spreading information from all over the world, the fashion centers like Paris and London, to even the most remote parts of America. And then finally you have the development of commercial patterns. So all three of these work together to hand Celestia this moment where she could create her own identity.
So that is the story told by just one beautiful pale gray dress with buttonholes that are too small and off-center pleats at the back. There are many more on display at the Portsmouth Athenaeum. The exhibit is called Embellishments, Constructing Victorian Detail, and runs until November 6th. You can learn more about the exhibit and its curator, the costume historian Astrida Schaefer, at wordofmouthradio.org. And now for a different kind of museum detective. Producer Ari Erlbaum brings us this profile of the founder of a museum in Portland, Maine, who spends his days searching for clues about creatures that might not exist.
When Lauren Coleman was 11 years old, he watched a Japanese monster movie.
Half Human is the fantastic motion picture record of the search for the mountain creature of Asia, whose name has become a symbol of terror and mystery, the abominable snowman.
The next day at school, he asked his teachers about the Yeti.
And they gave me three answers. They don't exist, get back to your schoolwork, leave me alone. So that encouraged me to do my own research.
57 years later, he's still researching.
This is a mold taken from the footprint found outside the cabin door.
I've slept in a cabin in the Trinity Alps where there was Bigfoot sightings where they would take the antenna on cars and break them off. And I put out peanut butter and hoped that something would come, and it didn't come.
Lauren's research has been a constant in his life. When he was 12, he started writing letters back and forth with scientists and monster hunters. In college, he studied anthropology and zoology. He searched for grains of truth in folklore and interviewed countless witnesses.
It's always been cryptozoology as my out, my way to really get in touch with how much I love animals, how much I love mysteries, how much I think there's really unknown in this world.
Cryptozoology is the study of cryptids, animals that haven't been proven by science to exist. The most famous cryptids are Bigfoots, Yetis, and the Loch Ness Monster. Cryptozoologists take a scientific approach to this tabloid material. They seek proof that cryptids are real.
By measuring the width, the length, the depth of the print, their composite picture described the species as being 9 feet tall and weighing around 1,800 pounds.
During the Victorian times, the main way of proving that a fantastic beast, a creature, a cryptid actually existed was to go out and shoot one. That really is in disfavor nowadays because you might actually be shooting one of the last four or five. Most of the cryptids, we think, have very small breeding populations.
Lauren is now one of the world's most prominent cryptozoologists. He's gone on cryptid-finding expeditions, written books, and appeared on TV shows. 12 years ago, he opened the International Cryptozoology Museum in Portland, Maine.
So you have Yeti material in here. You have the Orang Pindek from Sumatra, a skunk ape, Bigfoot Sasquatch.
In the museum, there are hairs, fecal samples, and casts of footprints in glass display cases.
And then down at the end, you have lake monsters, sea serpents, mystery cats. You go a little swing around, and you'll see the mapaguari, which are reports from South America.
Artist impressions and fake taxidermies are stacked on shelves. They depict bizarre-looking cryptids of all types.
There you can actually see a dart gun that was used in the 50s to try to get one of the Bigfoot.
Amy and Alan Lewis are visitors to the museum from Rhode Island. They are here for their wedding anniversary.
From an archival standpoint, that's actually really impressive that they have the actual real. I work in a library, so thinking about just in general the collection of ephemera, it's actually really impressive.
They soon find themselves face to face with the Bigfoot.
I understand why it says don't touch the fingers because I really want to. I'm going to. All right, you have to get my picture before we go.
Oh, yeah, clearly.
I really want to touch that hand.
No.
Okay.
You can.
I'm not going. Don't touch the hand.
Okay, so you're probably wondering, Bigfoots, sea monsters, aren't those just the stuff of cheesy B-movies? Lauren says that they may exist, but he's pretty sure they're not part of an extraterrestrial government mind control scheme or anything like that.
What happens is that stories get exaggerated because that's what humans do with the unknown.
This is the claw that reaches out to kill.
He tries to keep things scientific. He won't even start investigating sightings or evidence until he does what he calls a psychosocial background check.
We're always very cautious of true believers that every piece of evidence they find is a Bigfoot, a monster. We talk to their relatives, their parents, people they work with, police departments in some town, and you can very quickly find out, oh, they've been telling tall tales for their whole life, they have a mental health problem, or they're really credible.
Lauren is also wary of people on the other end of the spectrum.
Debunkers. Debunkers come into any situation. It may be a good piece of evidence, but they'll throw it out because they don't, quote unquote, believe in the cryptid.
Lauren points out that cryptozoology has been successful in the past.
The mountain gorilla, the okapi, a giant squid, all of those used to be cryptids. All of them used to be part of cryptozoology, and then they became part of zoology. For the mountain gorilla, for instance, there were tales for over 60 years of these giant creatures, almost like King Kong-like beasts that would go around squeezing to death native women and killing explorers. Slowly, people started trying to hunt the mountain gorilla down, and then it was shot there in the volcanic valleys of Kenya.
Lauren doesn't expect the celebrity cryptids to be found anytime soon. His bets are on a hominid called the orang pendek,
which is a little 3.5 feet tall creature in Indonesia, and it's a creature that's been seen often enough. There's good evidence of footprints, there's hair samples, and it actually is in a contained enough area where there's other kinds of creatures that are pretty rare that have been seen and known about.
Creatures like the orang pendek hold the same excitement for Lauren that the Yeti did when he was 11.
I keep very young by being in this field. There's new reports coming in, there's new people to meet, there's new researchers that come through here, so it's always changing.
For Salt Radio, this is Ari Erlbaum.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. New Hampshire is about to get a double dose of the Mekons. Tonight, a documentary film called Revenge of the Mekons is showing at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth. And next Friday, the band that's ridden the rails from punk to cowpunk to post-punk but remains a rollicking live band is going to be playing at 3S.
When I was crying at home in bed, where were you?
Never heard of the Mekons? Well, don't feel badly. That's part of their charm. I'll give you the abridged version. The Mekons formed in 1977 when punk rock slammed into England. A few art students from Leeds University who couldn't play music borrowed instruments from Gang of Four, a real band, and made a surprising hit record. It was called Never Been in a Riot. Out of tune, self-deprecating, and slightly slapstick, they rejected rock star pomposity and bravado. No band photos on posters, no individual names, but they copped the name of a comic book villain and became the Mekons. Here's American Psycho director and longtime fan Mary Herron. She's reading from the 1979 review she wrote of the band for Melody Maker magazine. The title, Amateur Night Meets the Avant-Garde.
The Mekons are not art rock, but they're not authentic primitives either. What they are is a strange combination of sophisticated theory and technical incompetence, which is what allowed them to develop a complex justification of amateurism while spontaneously putting their ideas into practice.
Four hours! Get a job, get a car, get a bed!
They got me in because I had a drum kit. That's the only reason they asked me to join the band, I think. Because Tom was like, do you want to be in a band where no one can play?
And those clips are from the Revenge of the Mekons documentary by the director Joe Angio. The last voice you heard was John Langford, one of the original members still active in the band. I got to speak with John and with Sally Timms, one of the 8 current Mekons, while the band was together at a house in Miller Beach, Indiana, to rehearse for the U.S. tour.
Well, I'm on the phone to them. Could you just, for 20 minutes, just go and sit in a different room?
It's lovely outside.
Please?
It's really nice outside.
Sally was a student at Leeds, also in a band, but who actually pursued a career in music. After singing on a few Mekons records, she eventually folded in.
In about the mid-80s, I just kind of got inducted into the band. If you waited long enough and hung around long enough, then you'd inevitably end up being in the Mekons. Even you would. Virginia, if you were around us long enough, you would be in the Mekons. It just seems to kind of absorb everyone by osmosis somehow. So that's how it works.
But before that, let's roll back to the epic. Buoyed by the punk wave, the Leeds-era Mekons got signed and soon dropped by Virgin Records. The remainder circled the drain for a while, but then revived to support a 1984 miners' strike against Margaret Thatcher. The Mekons soldiered on, expanding and contracting, but mostly expanding into a kind of collective of musicians who really could play. And in 1985, the Mekons busted out Fear and Whiskey, one of the earliest examples of the insurgent, raw, alt-country movement. The album was a game changer among musicians and critics, but as we hear in the film, critics don't buy records. After a few more albums influenced by country and by English folk, the Mekons got signed by another major label, this time A&M Records, and put out an album called Rock and Roll. The documentary shows some hilarious promotional footage for Rock and Roll, but the album was gritty and raw at a time when Milli Vanilli and Janet Jackson were topping the charts. The record went nowhere, and the Mekons got dropped again. But by then, the idea of becoming rock stars didn't seem all that interesting.
I think we had some excursions with major labels, you know, and it kind of just cured us of any interest in that side of things. Why we went back to A&M in 1989, I'm not really sure. We gave it another chance, and it's just never been a good time for us when we've had other people with the fingers in the pie too deeply. The best times for the band have really been when we thought nobody was that interested in us. So I think that's when the really creative moments have come about, when we just didn't think there was anything at stake. We're not really good employees, if you know what I mean.
The eight core Mekons now travel from England, from the US, from Central Asia, sometimes to make records, though not since 2011, more often to play live shows.
I would say I am the wrangler for the band, but John is definitely the pusher of the giant hefty cart. He is able to still be enthusiastic enough to get us all into gear, and then I often deal with the logistical issues of making sure that everyone gets on a plane and gets here, which was close to not happening in the last 2 weeks. Mm.
But still, you all make your way to rehearse, to make music, and to go out on the road, which takes a lot of energy, you know, especially if you're not being ushered from luxury hotel to luxury hotel.
That's true, although I will say that I think that kind of touring is probably way more draining because it's boring. And touring for a band on our level isn't boring. I think once you move into those really corporate ways of touring, then the only thing you see is just another hotel and the inside of a stadium, and you may as well be anywhere.
No bitter breakups, no battles over money, no debauchery followed by drug addiction, followed by rehab. The Mekons are still essentially amateurs. They have homes and kids and day jobs as an artist, paralegal, an art gallery owner, a web designer. 38 years on, the band that Lester Bangs called the most revolutionary in the history of rock and roll's most radical act may be rejecting the crash and burn model and growing up gracefully. The Mekons continue to create new music, still inspire passionate fans, still tour, and are still a band best known for not being known, although this documentary film could blow their cover.
We would have much preferred it if they'd hired young, attractive actors to read a scripted version of, you know, what we thought the Mekons were about.
Who do you think should have played you, John?
Me? I don't know. I'm saying younger and more attractive, but it would have to be Anthony Hopkins, really. So. Brad Pitt in a fat suit.
I was thinking... With 20 albums behind them, the Mekons have not lost their sense of humor. But they have redefined their notion of professional success.
I think for an outsider, I would say that the thing that I would take away from it, if I were looking at us, is that, you know, you can persevere in the face of obstacles and still be able to do things that have value in the world. And value to me isn't how much money you make. So that would be a success, in my opinion, that we're still able to do this.
Was there ever a point where you just thought, forget this, I don't need to do it anymore?
Daily. Hourly.
So what turns it around for you?
I don't know. It's great. It's really great. And it's really privileged, you know, to be able to go out. The fact that there's, you know, most of this tour is already, the gigs are sold out, and it's going to be really great fun. So I get to see some of the people who are dearest to me, you know, in my life. So we're all geographically spread out across the planet. It's hard to get together. So this is a great excuse. You know, we don't go fishing for the weekend. We just have a punk rock band.
Revenge of the Mekons, a documentary by Joe Angio, is playing at 3S Art Space tonight. The Mekons are playing live at 3S next Friday. That's July 24th. You find much more on the gigs at 3S, more on the film and their music, and some clips of my extended interview with Sally Timms and John Langford. All that is at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, the Mekons show no signs of slowing down or retiring, and they are not alone. Almost 8 million Americans over 65 are still working, a rising number of them hitting the road to chase low-wage jobs across the country. We'll hear about how an increasing number of them are living on the highways of America after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Aging is not what it used to be. For many people, the image of retirement was once packing everything into an RV and driving across the country and visiting national parks and tourist attractions and experiencing the freedom of the open road. Today, pensions are rare and foreclosures have wiped out equity and delayed those dreams for legions of Americans. Journalist Jessica Bruder explored the rising number of Americans who have adapted by hitting the road to chase low-wage jobs across the country. These older migrants ride a circuit of seasonal jobs, picking fruit or selling Christmas trees, stocking warehouse shelves, and taking tickets at Dollywood, struggling to stay one expensive car repair or injury ahead of tragedy. Jessica wrote about what happens when you can't afford to stop working in an article called The End of Retirement, and we spoke to her when the article came out in Harper's. Well, first, give us a sense of the numbers of aging Americans who are working beyond traditional retirement and how those expectations have changed.
Well, there are lots of them, and the growth is pretty staggering. Nearly 7.7 million Americans, 65 and older, were still working last year. That's up 60% from a decade earlier. And we're still in an era where you've got almost three quarters, 71% of Americans who are pre-retirees, that's 50 to 65, they envision retirement as a time of leisure, but only 17% of those people expect that they won't work at all in later years. That's according to a survey from AARP.
Yeah. And you met several people who call themselves these work campers, travelers, nomads, picking up mostly seasonal work. One of them, Linda May, how did she end up on the road?
Linda May was living in New River, Arizona, in a trailer, working as a Home Depot cashier. She's a pretty formidable woman. She's been everything from an insurance executive to working in construction to being a cocktail waitress. Worked hard all her life, but like many Americans, never had a job that brought her any kind of lasting security. So she doesn't, obviously, have a pension. And pretty much realized that she was going to be trapped rattling around that trailer and working as a Home Depot cashier. She realized that she was going to be working that job to pay the rent for the rest of her life with no retirement in sight. And she thought that was rather silly. So she ended up saving, putting all the money she could put together into an RV that was a little beat up. It had just run into a telephone pole, but Linda's, you know, she's crafty. She can fix it. So she decided to go out on the road. She'd heard about people who were living on just $500 a month, which is what she realized she'd be getting in Social Security. Mm. So she figured she would have more working flexibility if she were living on the road.
And Linda, like many others, found work at an Amazon warehouse in Fernley, Nevada. And it's one of several facilities that Amazon is actively recruiting these RV dwellers into what it calls its Amazon camper force. So what's the appeal for Amazon?
It's counterintuitive at first because these jobs at Amazon are very, very physical. You're standing on a concrete floor for, 10 hours with a couple of little breaks, but it's not easy. You're lifting, you're squatting, you're stooping, you're going upstairs. I did meet people who'd been injured. So you wouldn't think they'd want older people, but the thing with older people is they show up and they keep showing up. I've listened to several online seminars, talked to a former Camper Force recruiter, and what I hear said over and over again, both on the employer and the employee end, is that this is a generation of people with a real work ethic, with pride. They're not strutting around saying, I'm too good for this kind of work. And at the same token, they just keep showing up. They do it.
And you mentioned what a tough, physically demanding job it is. How does Amazon handle injuries or caring for older workers?
Several folks told me that Amazon, several people who'd been working in the warehouses, told me that Amazon has these on-site facilities called AmCare. So that's the equivalent of a first aid, first responder station. For serious injuries, they need to be taken out by ambulance. A lot of people are also just, hitting the over-the-counter pain relievers as much as they can. Several workers also told me that those are made available free of charge in the warehouses.
Hmm. Peak time for the Amazon warehouses is around Christmas time. Think about the conditions of living in the cold, where do they park? Tell us a little bit about what life is like when they're not in the Amazon warehouse or other jobs.
Well, basically, when they are parked, so if they're working at Amazon, there's a big cluster of RV parks stretching as far as Reno, where they park. And it gets pretty cold. And Fernley, I was there in October, and not that long after I left, there was snow on the ground. So people are wrapping heat tape around their pipes. Their water's freezing. I talked about a lot of folks have pets. They're buying electric heaters because they don't want to run the propane when they're gone to keep their pets warm. It's not an easy way to live in the wintertime.
Mm. We're speaking with journalist Jessica Bruder. She dove into this subculture now being lived by a number of people of retirement age. They're crisscrossing the country in RVs and campers, chasing seasonal jobs. They're sometimes called the Okies of the Great Recession. People call them war campers and migrants. Those riding on the economy's outermost edge. The article she wrote for Harper's is called The End of Retirement. And talk to us a little bit about this sort of concept of retirement. You dig into the history and the reversal that it suffered of late. Can you summarize that for us?
Absolutely. So retirement is a relatively new invention in the U.S. For most of the history of humankind, people worked until they died or were too infirm to work, at which point they tended not to stick around for very long anyway. The idea of it actually began in Germany, where the statesman Otto von Bismarck came up with the concept in 1883. The idea was that everyone who was unemployed over 65 would get a pension. This was actually to fend off Marxist agitation at the time, and not many Germans made it to that age way back then. In the U.S., obviously, the New Deal is what brought us Social Security. In the Great Depression, we had so many workers and not enough jobs, so part of the initial idea of retirement was to clear out space in the workforce for the younger generation while also giving older people a well-deserved break if they'd worked all their lives. So that's where it came from. But if you think of other reforms, retirement has become a bit controversial, but some things like, the weekend, for example, mm-hmm. we're not ready to give up. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to me that it's become such a third rail in politics.
The reason it is such a big discussion in politics is because of the huge amount of entitlements that have to be paid in the future. But one of the things that you write about is that people of 65 and older are more dependent on Social Security than any other source, which was really surprising to me.
Absolutely. And this is something that isn't just a handout. It's something, you pay into Social Security all your life. And if you're in a higher wage job, you get more Social Security. And if you're in a lower wage job, you get less. So it's not, I feel like there's a lot of talk as if it's a handout. And I definitely don't think it is. Mm. But the problem is, around the time of the New Deal, this was never supposed to support people completely in retirement. It was supposed to be a supplement that would complement your existing pension. Now, pensions have ceded to 401ks, which has been a failed experiment, if you ask me. And at the same time, we assume that people would have savings and investments. But for a lot of people today, people were cleaned out by the Great Recession. Not everybody, but a lot of people.
And like Linda, had no pension. She had worked most of her life in low-wage jobs, a blue-collar worker for the most part. But you met many others, a former academic advisor, a former cowboy, a former radio producer, which, you know, was chilling to me, and Chuck Stout, who for 45 years was an executive with the McDonald's Corporation. Now, how did he end up in an RV?
Sure. For Chuck, for some of those years, he owned and ran a franchise, but for a couple of those years in the 70s, he was actually the head of product development for McDonald's Global, which is
huge
kind
job.
Of blew my mind. Yeah, as his wife likes to chime in, Chuck is the reason they have ice cream. And then Chuck always says, oh, honey, it was my team. It was my team. But yeah, I mean, Chuck worked hard. He made some bad investments that didn't pan out. His nest egg, he had around $200,000 that got wiped in the recession, and it was enough to push him out. He and his wife declared bankruptcy. They had a small house, but it was a house on a golf course. They lost that. They lost the car. They ended up buying an RV for, I believe, $500 off of Barb's brother because he didn't need it anymore. That's Chuck's wife's brother. And they took off on the road. And, you know, Chuck is 70, and he was doing the picker job in the warehouse, which is, by all accounts, the hardest job. It's the most active one.
Well, at the end of the season, many of the RV dwellers head to Quartzsite, Arizona, which somebody calls the Burning Man for geezers, and find camaraderie. They swap stories. They swap hints. What are some of the kinds of transient survival tips that get shared there?
Well, I was lucky in that I got to sit in on some really amazing skill shares and seminars at the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous, which is organized each year by a fellow named Bob Wells. They were talking about how you can go to Los Algodones, Mexico to get cheap dental care, how to do stealth parking so people don't harass you when you're sleeping in your car in a place that is otherwise public, how to cook with fire, how to patch a flat, how to install solar panels on your RV, how to talk to your family about what you're doing. I mean, it was really a pretty fascinating community, and watching them collaborate to make it work for themselves was pretty cool, actually.
Well, this seasonal work is working out right now for people like Linda May and Chuck Stout and others. But what about when they are 75, 85? Is there a strategy in sight for the folks that you spoke with?
Some of them are doing their best to get through the day and trying not to think about it. I mean, I definitely started worrying. I mean, I liked these people, frankly. I came to worry about them. So I started asking. Linda May, because of her construction experience, she's planning to go in on a patch of land with her daughter and try to build this marvel of 70s passive sustainable architecture called an Earthship. There's somebody else who I talked to who said, "Let me die on the road." The scary thing is, when I talked to tons of people, I actually did hear about a couple people who had died on the road living in RVs parked far from family. There are people who, as folks have for generations, will fall back on their children. A lot of people don't like doing that. They don't want to strain younger families, and they want their autonomy, but sometimes they don't have a choice.
Well, Jessica Bruder, thank you for your story and filling us in today.
Thanks for having me.
Jessica Bruder, she wrote about the rising number of retirement-aged Americans who work low-wage seasonal jobs across the country. Her article, The End of Retirement, was in Harper's Magazine, and you'll find a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, where your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast awaits you. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like it, please write a review and pass it along. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.
We'll be right back.